Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment with the upheavals in the Middle East and the extent to which the US is sidelined and hampered by its close relationship with Israel, whose leadership facing increasing international isolation, according to warnings from Israel's top intelligence officials, could resort to dangerous misadventures and rashly strike Iran and trigger a regional war. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was Colin Powell's chief of staff during the first Bush administration, joins us to offer his analysis of how the U.S. military feels about its involvement in an increasingly unstable region. Then we will examine the role of the Congress in terms of the War Powers Act, following Friday's vote in the House to rebuke President Obama for continuing America's role in the NATO operation in Libya. Constitutional lawyer and former Deputy Attorney General in the Reagan administration, Bruce Fine, joins us. Then we'll be joined in the studio by Annie Jacobson, who has written a groundbreaking book about the ultra-secret Area 51 in the Nevada desert. Area 51, the uncensored history of America's top-secret military base. We will talk about aliens, UFOs, and other secrets of the ultimate black site, so stay tuned. I'm now joined by Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was Secretary of State Colin Powell's Chief of Staff at the Department of State from August 2002 to January of 2005. He began working with Powell as his Deputy Executive Officer starting in 1989, and Colonel Wilkerson served as the Deputy Director and Director of the United States Marine Corps War College at Quantico, Virginia. He rejoined Powell's staff as a civilian in the State Department. And in October of 2005, Colonel Wilkerson, after considerable soul-searching, went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace at Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. He currently teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
Thanks, Ian. I'm driving down the beautiful Shenandoah Valley, so I hope I don't lose you.
Well, I hope so, too. Now, there's an extraordinary story coming out of Israel. I wanted to talk to you about the Arab Spring and the extent to which the notion that there's a democratic change underway is contradicted by the facts that essentially in Tunisia and in Egypt we have military regimes. The military is key. It's split in Libya. It's key to the survival of the regime in Syria, and it appears to be splitting in Yemen. But let me begin with an extraordinary story that's coming out of Israel, out of the Haaretz, one of the major newspapers there, suggesting, but three of the top Israeli officials from intelligence, from the head of the Mossad, the head of military intelligence, and the head of Shin Bet, have all to one degree or another gone public and suggested that the fact that they're not behind the scenes as a counterweight to Mr. Netanyahu and Mr. Barak, that there's a possibility that as Israel becomes more and more isolated, particularly as the Palestinians go towards statehood in September through the United Nations, that the Israeli administration of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu might conduct a dangerous misadventure and attack Iran, and that could lead to a regional war, thus warns the former head of Mossad, Maya Dagan. Do you take this seriously?
I've heard last night from some friends in the intelligence community that there may be some political motivations behind all three individual statements that I'm not privy to right now, and so once I am privy to them, I might be a little bit more surprised at why they said it. That said, there's also another possibility, and that is that we're seeing a orchestrated campaign of pressure here, pressure there by the Israelis. I don't think it's that. I do think there are probably some political motivations, particularly for the former head of Mossad. But that said, I think they're right in the sense that this is a government which is ultra right wing. Its main purpose in life is more space, Lebensraum, if you will. Its purpose is to hold on to the West Bank, to make sure Jerusalem is Israeli and Israeli only, and maybe even greater than that. So it's a very dangerous regime. It's dangerous for the security of Israel, and it's dangerous for the security of the United States because we are so hell-bent to be wrapped in with Israel come hell or high water.
So is our situation vis-a-vis Israel, clearly it's at loggerheads with the entreaties to be on the right side of the Arab Spring. And I imagine as the clock ticks towards September and the Palestinians go through their statehood route through the United Nations, that will put the U.S. in an untenable position in terms of vetoing the formation of a new state. So,
And the sad thing about that, in my view, is it does not have to be that way at all. It could be a wonderful opportunity. After all, Israel is, as we often say, the only democracy in the region. Israel should be helping these movements, aiding these movements, doing what she can to ensure that the movements produce democratic success, representative, tolerant government, and so forth, instead of being scared to death and acting as if she's angry with the United States because we're abandoning one tyrant after the other. This is a wonderful opportunity to put the United States and Israel, two democracies, behind what are basically youth movements in favor of a higher standard of living, a better standard of living in all of these countries, but have unique connotations in each of them. Tunisia's not Bahrain, Bahrain's not Saudi Arabia, and so forth, and make sure that over the next decade or two, these movements have a successful outcome. And yet, neither one of our governments, Tel Aviv or Washington, is really focused on this. What we're focused on is protecting the former policies, which are, in essence, supporting dictators in order to get their oil.
And when the former head of Mossad suggests, as he did, that it was foolish for the Israelis to ignore the Saudi peace initiative, do you think that given the changes on the ground and the extent to which even Saudi Arabia may well be a victim of its own Arab Spring at some point or other, how much room does the U.S. have to operate? Because we know that President Obama had to preempt Netanyahu's speech by making that speech as he did on the eve of Netanyahu's visit. He was invited by the Republicans in the Congress to make a speech, and the speech was treated with endless applause from the Congress. So given this is a coming election year, it seems to me that politics are going to circumscribe strategic interests here, unless somebody shows some initiative and courage as the clock ticks here till September.
Well, I think you're right. Those 26 standing ovations for Bibi Netanyahu reminded me of people in Berlin in the 33, 34, 35 time frame who would stand on the street and go, "Sieg Heil, Sieg Heil, Sieg Heil." And if you didn't do that, someone would come over and bash you. An SA trooper would put a club upside your head. This is ridiculous, this kind of obeisance and obsequiousness in regard to another state, and particularly in regard to another foreign leader appearing before our Congress and essentially having the Congress, in doing it, stand up against and oppose the policy of the President of the United States. And the fact that there were Democrats standing up there doing that is utterly appalling. So, it's a dangerous time. It's an extremely dangerous time if we can't break away from that kind of obsequiousness and formulate a good policy. And it's not just dangerous for the United States. It's dangerous for Israel, too. Israel is not going to grow at the expense of those around her. She is not going to gain additional space without 400 million Arabs taking her on, and ultimately without others like the Turks, who are growing increasingly angry with Tel Aviv, taking them on too. So if you want to become a pariah, if you want to become an apartheid state, if you want to become so isolated that you have no friends left, keep going on the same policy track you're on, Israel.
So, again, I'm speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was Secretary of State Colin Powell's Chief of Staff in the Department of State from August 2002 to January 2005. He was also the Director of the United States Marine Corps War College at Quantico, Virginia. What is the feeling inside the United States military in terms of its footprint in that region? We know that there's a hope that we'll get out of Iraq without any problems, but the Secretary of Defense Gates said that we're not getting out of Afghanistan soon, and I would assume that the broader movements inside the Middle East, particularly with the Arab Spring, would be affecting the calculus. And how much is that going to hamper us if we're on the wrong side of history here?
I think it's going to hamper us dramatically. And we're not going to leave either Afghanistan or Iraq anytime soon. The Iraq report rendered by Bin Lando's group in Baghdad, and Lando's been there for at least 7 years, as I recall, living in Baghdad the whole time, just reported that Iraq has 100 billion barrels for sure, 200 billion barrels probably, and at the outside and in everyone's dreams, 300 billion barrels. Those latter two equal or dwarf Saudi Arabia's known reserves. We are not getting out of Iraq anytime soon, and any American who believes we are smoking something. We are also not getting out of Afghanistan, and Afghanistan is a completely different situation for oil and gas pipelines involved, but also Pakistan involved, and Pakistan is probably the most dangerous place on the face of the earth right now. It isn't Iran, it's Pakistan. We're looking at the possibility of a splintered military, a splintered ISI, and an utterly incompetent civilian government, and 120 or so nuclear weapons lying around loose. This is not a place that the United States can afford to ignore, as it has so often and inconsistently over the past 40 years. So this is a very dangerous region of the world with a lot of promise and a lot of opportunity, as you pointed out, with this so-called Arab Spring happening. But it's not an area that the United States can afford to abandon, even though the tendency and the pressures to do so are going to grow as our fiscal situation gets worse and worse, and I firmly believe it is going to get a lot worse before it begins to get any better.
So, Colonel Wilkerson, given that you mentioned Iraq, let's just start with Iraq before we go to Pakistan. My understanding is that the ultimate folly of the Iraq war was that, and this is what Brent Scowcroft warned against, is that it strategically it's only going to make Iran stronger, and clearly that is the case. So, given the figures you gave on this extraordinary oil reserves that Iraq has that dwarf Saudi Arabia, and there's already talk that Saudis may have reached peak oil in any case, this is the world's greatest supply of oil we're talking about here. Does the U.S., after all of its treasure and sacrifice there, have any influence, or at least as much or more influence than Iran, over who gets that oil?
Well, there's 2 points here. One is that when, as you rightly point out, we destroy the balance of power in the Gulf by taking down Saddam Hussein, Iran's previous balancer, we became the balancer. So that's another reason why either offshore or onshore or a combination of the two, we have to stay. With regard to the oil, the markets are such that, and I think they'll stay this way for some time, as long as you assure the Strait of Hormuz is open, as long as you assure the pipelines are pumping, whether they be the ones that run north through Turkey or the ones that are going to run east and south, you are okay as far as this oil is concerned. You don't have to buy it and you don't have to own it. As a matter of fact, the first contracts that Maliki is signing, the biggest one is with Malaysia. Others are with China. I think the smallest contract that's been signed this year is with a private company. I think it's Chevron. All the other contracts are with national companies, and by that I mean companies owned by states, by countries. So as long as you assure the oil flows and makes it to the market and the price stays reasonably stable, and that's another issue, our presence there, offshore or onshore, or a combination of the two, as I said, which is more likely, is a good presence. It's a presence that's necessary to ensure the world's oil continues to flow as it should, particularly if this is indeed another Saudi Arabia, which most of my friends in the oil business clearly expect it to be.
So, Colonel Wilkerson, turning to Pakistan, what can the United States do to help a country that in many ways doesn't seem to want to help itself, and it As you know, there's an enormous amount of anti-Americanism there and a tendency to blame America for everything, notwithstanding that the Pakistanis have made considerable sacrifices in the war on terror. They've lost many, many more of their soldiers than we have. However, we know from the recent bin Laden raid that that raises some very, very serious questions. Which are pretty difficult to answer. One is, did the top leadership know? They say they didn't. Therefore, if they didn't know, then the leadership below that, elements within the ISI knew that they were hosting bin Laden. Therefore, that raises the question about the custody of the nuclear weapons if there are rogue elements within the command structure. So, none of this is particularly good.
No, it isn't. And one of the most ironic things is that it is our presence in Afghanistan and constant drone strikes in the Pakistan and so forth that is most destabilizing. The one interesting fact, in the last 96 hours or so, polling was showing, some very good polling was showing, that 90% or better of the Pakistani people believe the number one enemy to their state was us, the United States of America. Not bin Laden, not the Taliban, not Islamabad, their own government, but us. Recently, some quick polling has shown that switched a little bit. They now feel that perhaps one of the biggest enemies, really ironic, is their own military. And probing that polling a little bit, it looks like what they perceive to be their military's incompetence in letting the United States get bin Laden under their feet, as it were. So this is an incredible development. If the one institution in Pakistan that gave it some stability, the military, is suddenly distrusted, mistrusted by the Pakistani people to the point where there is no institution in Pakistan at all, that's going to make the place enormously more dangerous. And even though our presence in Afghanistan and our drone strikes and other strikes into Pakistan are destabilizing for the country, I don't see any way that we can back off and say, okay, now be stable. Because the destabilizing, the instability, seems to be permanent, at least for the moment. I don't know how you get around that, frankly.
Well, some people have suggested to me that we should call both the big regional players bluff, and the extent to which the Afghan war is a surrogate war between India and Pakistan, which many suggested it is, that we're almost spectators to somebody else's war. And also, ironically, where our soldiers are protecting Chinese copper mines. So I'm wondering two things. One is whether you can just tell the Indians and the Pakistanis, okay, if you're fighting over this, and then go ahead and sort it out, and let China become the new, be responsible for Pakistan. Is that
I'm on the same sheet of music with you, and I would bring Turkey and I would bring Iran into that too, because they have stakes in the region. I think a regional solution, monitored and kept safe, if you will, or secure at least, by regional powers, eventually is a whole lot better solution than a permanent presence of the United States in this region, which can only continue to be destabilizing for Pakistan and ultimately for others like Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and others too. I think you've got to bring powers like Turkey, Iran, India, China in, and you've got to make sure that the interests they have that are congruent with your own are looked after. In addition to the surrogate war, the proxy war, and I think you're right on that, we have a possibility, a very strong possibility, if we were to withdraw rather rapidly, of a truly vicious civil war redeveloping in Afghanistan as the Pashtun and non-Pashtun populations try to go back at one another, and they will simply say to hell with the Taliban. They won't care about the Taliban. They will simply start taking each other on. And it will take on the proportion of a civil war rapidly. And what that does to the proxy war is anybody's guess, because the Pakistanis are not going to like that at all. The Indians, of course, are going to love it. And China is not going to like the fact that the Pakistanis don't like it. So, yes, we've got to get regional powers interested in more than just their own little piece of the pie. and interested in a regional solution and then ultimately sustaining and protecting that regional solution. We cannot do this by ourselves. This is what alarms me the most, because I don't see us talking to Iran. I don't even see us talking to Turkey. And I certainly don't see us talking to China about these issues, too. Instead, we're fearful that they might get in there and do more than we do. I say, all power to them. Let them get in there and do more than we do, as long as it's bringing some sort of stability to the area.
Well, Colonel Wilkerson, I thank you so much for joining us here today on Background Briefing.
Surely. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Again, I was speaking... Bye-bye. And then, again, I was speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was Secretary of State Colin Powell's Chief of Staff at the Department of State from August 2002 to January 2005. He was also the Director of the United States Marine Corps War College at Quantico, Virginia. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about Congress and the War Powers Act.